From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Roseanne's other husband, we talk with actor John Goodman. His new movie is a remake of Born Yesterday. Stephen Schiff will review it later in the show. Also, the link between madness and genius. We talk with psychiatrist Kay Redfield Jamison, author of a new book about manic depression and the artistic temperament. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Boris Yeltsin and the Russian Congress of People's Deputies appeared today to have taken a step back from the brink of confrontation, with a wide variety of compromises emerging during the first day of the Emergency Congress. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
By the end of the day, only one formal draft resolution had emerged from the Congress to hold a referendum on early presidential and parliamentary elections in May, and if that's approved, to hold those new elections in Russia in October. But this was just the mildest of new ideas for breaking the deadlock in the dangerous struggle for power in Russia. The nation's chief judge, Valery Zorkin, produced a 10-point plan for ending the crisis, including a referendum on a new constitution, new elections, the creation of a real two-chamber legislature, and the elimination of the Congress itself, a holdover from Soviet days. President Yeltsin said he found Zorkin's proposals constructive, although Yeltsin is still insisting on his national vote of confidence in his administration at the end of April. The possibility of Yeltsin's impeachment seems to be fading by the hour. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
President Clinton and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl promised strong Western support today for democratic reforms in Russia. The president said that he's still working on the details of the U.S. aid package that he'll present to President Yeltsin next week in Vancouver. He said that he and Kohl were in general agreement on the approach. Kohl said that he and the president are aware that a setback to democracy in Russia would be much more expensive than any type of assistance that Germany and the United States might grant now. El Salvador's president, Alfredo Cristiani, said today that his government would not allow Salvadorans accused of human rights crimes during the Civil War to face extradition. As Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador, the government has not ratified a broad-based amnesty law that's been criticized by both the United Nations and the United States.
President Cristiani was responding to comments by the U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher that State Department lawyers could try to bypass the amnesty using international law. Cristiani said El Salvador's constitution would not allow extraditions. No one is going to bypass Salvadoran law, he said. The amnesty was forced through the National Assembly against the votes of opposition parties, 5 days after a UN-appointed truth commission blamed the army for the vast majority of crimes committed during the Civil War. Opposition leaders say the amnesty contradicts international treaties, where El Salvador has promised to respect human rights. The last week has seen an outspoken and threatening right-wing campaign against the truth commission recommendations. The National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 21 points to close at 3,440. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The United Nations said today that Bosnian Serbs have threatened to shoot down all planes dropping relief supplies over Bosnia if German planes take part in the operation. The German government has said it wants to join the United States in the operation, but that it's up to the UN to approve. UN officials disputed that it was up to the World Organization, but a UN spokesman confirmed that the Bosnian Serbs opposed German participation. Millions of Canadians will soon be offered a new insurance policy that allows them to come to the United States for certain medical procedures. Marge Pitroff of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
It's called called the Canada-America Healthcare Plan and was initiated by an insurance broker in Manitoba, frustrated about having to wait 18 months for hernia surgery. David Miller came to the United States for treatment and later approached an insurance company in Green Bay, Wisconsin, about providing Canadians with coverage for such cases. American Medical Security Incorporated agreed and next week begins offering a plan that would cost the average Canadian $325 a year. Spokesman Michael Beanup says the policy will cover non-acute medical services.
Certain diagnostic procedures such as CAT scans, MRIs, procedures like that that are not readily available in Canada, that's a procedure that is put on a waiting list.
According to Beena, 300,000 Canadians are currently on waiting lists for such services and for other non-emergency medical procedures such as hernia or knee surgery. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Kitroff in Milwaukee.
Police in Sacramento, California say that a police SWAT team shot and killed a gunman who was holding hostages in the office of the California Tax Board. Witnesses said the man fired several bursts of gunshots as he made his way into the 23-story office tower in downtown Sacramento. About 1,800 workers were evacuated, but no one was reported injured. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Everyone knows my guest as Roseanne's TV husband. My guest is John Goodman. During his breaks from Roseanne, he makes movies. His latest is a remake of Born Yesterday, which opened today. He also starred in Matinee as a horror movie impresario. He played a devilish salesman in Barton Fink. He played Babe Ruth in The Babe. He was Al Pacino's partner in Sea of Love and Sally Field's husband in Punchline. I asked him about his audition for Roseanne. What was he told about his character, Dan Connor?
Wow. They laid it real simple. Didn't really sketch it in much. Blue collar. I think they wanted somebody that could stand up to her. Whatever that means. Hire a redwood tree.
Did you think the series would catch on?
I had no idea. I'd never really done much television before. I tell people that I just read with Roseanne Barr at the time, and everybody was very interested in it. And then when we did the pilot, I tell people about it, and they thought, oh, yeah, well, we can't wait to see that, because she was pretty hot. And it worked out. But, I have no way of knowing these things. It was pretty much another job. I wanted to take it to get off the road for a while because I'd been living out of a suitcase.
What were you doing?
Doing films. I'd go from city to city, just an itinerant actor. I'd always pick up a new movie, and then I'd go to a new location, a new hotel, new Gideon Bible.
And you got tired of that?
Yeah, it got old.
What's it like to have a TV family? You know, all of us who grew up watching TV have always compared our families with the families that we watched on TV. Now, so now you have a TV family.
Yes, I do. I guess they're pretty much better paid than most families. I never really thought of them that much as a family, in as much as, you know, you think of a cast that you work with as family sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that's about the extent of it.
Who were the TV families that you really liked when you were young watching television?
I love the Cleavers. I think it ran on Saturday night in St. Louis and on ABC, and I couldn't wait to see him. I just loved Beaver, because he just seemed so real. He'd talk about the same things that we talked about. I think the writers had something going there. And then everybody knew an Eddie Haskell,
mm-hmm.
and everybody knew somebody like Beaver's older brother. And I really, you know, I grew up without a dad, so Ward was a little surreal anyway. But I dug them.
Did you ever?
I never really quite got Father Knows Best.
Not having a father when you were growing up, did you assume that real fathers were like Ward Cleaver and
I seen the guys next door. Hell, I knew what they were like. They were, for the most part, guys like Dan Connor.
Is there a laugh track on Roseanne?
No, there's a genuine studio audience there. They hype them up. They get them all pumped up on steroids, and a comedian comes out and gets everybody all jacked up, and They're pretty raring to go. I don't. You know what? They might sweeten it sometimes. I can't really say that honestly because I don't know. But the live audiences that are there are usually pretty good.
Does it make it like theater?
Yeah, it was tricky when I first started doing it because I was playing it like it was theater. I was playing to the audience instead of the cameras, and it's kind of a stupid thing to do.
I could see the temptation, though, because it's the audience that's giving you the reaction, not the camera.
Yeah, well, no, because the audience is watching video monitors. So you have to time things. You can't time things like you would normally. You have to time things to what the audience is watching, and you don't know half the time if they're watching you or if they're watching the monitor. Huh. So you just have to go with where the red light is.
Right. How was your life changed by people seeing you as Dan Connor, the character from Roseanne?
Well, I'm lost my anonymity for the most part, so it's a little difficult going places.
Do you think people are more presumptuous about approaching you when they know you're from TV as opposed to movies? Because you're at home with them.
Yeah, I've always felt that. I talk to people who do movies exclusively, and when you come into somebody's house, they're more familiar with you.
So do they try to get familiar with you when they run into you at a restaurant?
Oh, yeah, I'm like everybody's best friend. I get a lot of headlocks and back slaps and stuff like that. For the most part, I mean, people really mean well. They just they don't realize that it can be a little off-putting sometimes.
If you're a self-conscious person, does it make it even worse?
Yeah, and how? I mean, I got buddies that love it. They thrive on it. They love being recognized. I always see somebody looking at me and a little too long, I assume my fly's open.
You know, I'm thinking about how differently you handle fame from, say, Roseanne and Tom Arnold. And they've used fame to make their lives into performance pieces in a way.
Yeah, that's human life is a performance piece. That's very interesting. Now, Rose likes it. I'm uncomfortable with it.
Does that make for any tension around the set about how to use the fame of the people on the show? I mean, for instance, Roseanne and Tom get into these controversies all the time, whether it's about incest or Julia Louis-Dreyfus's parking spot. And do you try to stay clear of all of that?
You betcha. I'm not very confrontational. I'd just as soon not get into anything, just try to let things go along as they will. So there's no tension on the set, though. I mean, I just try to stay out of things.
Is it easy to stay out of it?
You bet.
My guest is John Goodman. He stars in the new movie Born Yesterday. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Goodman. Can we talk about your early life a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, you were born in St. Louis in 1952. Your father died before your second birthday, so your mother supported the family. Were you the only one of your friends from a single-parent family when you were growing up?
Yeah, actually, I believe I was. I never really thought about that, but yeah, everybody else had two parents.
Did that make you feel very different?
It did. I didn't dwell on it, but it was something that was at the back of my mind that I was aware of all the time. But it was, I to be honest, I wouldn't know what it would be like to grow up with a father. So I don't, you know, it was neither better nor worse. It was just different.
What did your mother do to make a living?
She would, she took in ironing sometimes. She had what was the equivalent of a daycare center now. They called it babysitting back then, but parents would go to work and they'd drop their kids off at the house. So we played I mean, it must have been rough on Mom, but we played a lot, had a lot of fun. And then she was a clerk at a drugstore, and she worked at a barbecue joint when I was in high school, so I could steal her tips.
Were you watching a lot of movies, TV, listening to a lot of music when you were young?
At that age, the TV would keep breaking, so I read a lot. But, we'd go to the Crest show on matinee days and see stuff, see movies. But, I watched a little bit of television.
You just starred in the movie Matinee. Did you ever see any of the William Castle movies?
I sure did. I saw 13 Ghosts. I really enjoyed the hell out of that with the 3D glasses that you had to put on at certain times during the movie so you could see the ghosts come out of the screen and stuff. It was neat.
Did you save the glasses?
No, but who was I talking to? The guy from Entertainment Tonight, Leonard Maltin, has got his 13 ghost glasses.
So you said you read a lot of books. What kind of books would you read?
Good stuff. For the most part, stuff you're supposed to read, like Stevenson and Mark Twain. And then when I got in like seventh and eighth grade, I turned into a little James Bond nerd. I'd go and get these paperbacks. I don't know where the hell I got the money from. And then read them. I turned into quite the little geek.
What's geeky about reading James Bond, though? Those weren't geeky books.
What a cool guy.
Yeah, well, I read just about all of them, I think.
I was like a chubby 11-year-old with broken glasses, dirty pants, and just, picture myself on the Riviera chain-smoking Galois.
You know what I remember?
Talking to some other seventh grade girl. Suave.
Well, one thing that I'll always remember from the James Bond books is his comma of black hair.
Oh, his comma of black hair that fell down over his right eye.
Yeah.
His tiger sinewed body.
There were some descriptions that would be exactly the same, I think, in every book.
Yeah, and they fit me pretty damn well at the time, I think.
So what were the big turning points in your pre-acting life?
I think a lot of it revolved around athletics. I had a cousin that played football at Missouri University when I was in fourth grade, and the sun rose and set on him, and that's what I wanted to do. So I play football a lot, whenever I could, and when I got into high school, that's what I geared everything towards was high school football, and I was terrible. I mean, I wasn't very good. I was slow, lazy. But the fact that I was on a team and wearing a uniform, I think, made it. I was a football player.
So it made it easier to get dates?
Well, no. I mean, let's not say that. I was very, very shy, very backwards. I didn't get my first date until I was 16 years old, and it was a fix-up job. And halfway there to the girl's house, I begged my friend to stop the car, let me out. I've got to sty anything, I've got to get out of this. But I went through with it, and then, I didn't have a girlfriend until I was in college, really.
Because you were shy?
Yeah, pathologically.
So even the uniform didn't help that, huh?
No, I kind of dwelt in my own fantasy world, I guess, but... I had really bad crushes on girls, and I never had the guts to follow through on it. I wasn't a stalker or anything. But...
There is this real connection between performers and shyness, and I think a lot of people find it hard to understand how you could be so big on stage.
I was reading an article
Peter
Fonda talking about his father. He said that his father, he finally discovered that he wasn't angry at him. He just was extremely shy. And I thought that was fascinating.
But I bet you were the kind of shy person who, when you felt really comfortable, could be very extroverted.
Oh, very much so. At parties, when things were going a little too slowly for my speed, I'd just get up and start jumping around like a madman, just grabbing things and improvising and goofing around, getting everybody going. And I just thrived on that.
Do you remember?
But that's, I guess, how I expressed myself to girls, which at that time in your life is the big thing you're trying to impress.
Right. Do you remember the very first time you got drunk?
Wow. Yeah, I sure do. I was in. I stayed over. We went out. We snuck out. I was supposed to be staying over at somebody's house. We snuck out. We went up to a driving range and took all the golf balls from the driving range and threw them into the swimming pool next door. And somebody had a bottle of rum. And, God, I must have drank half a bottle of rum. And I was still going the next morning. I slept, woke up, didn't know where I was. Went over to a friend of mine's house, and I was still about half looped. Not pretty.
Did you pattern any of your behavior on having watched a lot of movies where people got drunk and did crazy things?
No. No, this was, it was all new to me. I mean, I didn't have a red nose and a broken top hat and hang out on a lamppost and go hick or anything. I have little bubbles come out of my mouth.
So when you went to college, were you on the football team?
No, I wasn't. I went down, I did a year at a junior college because I didn't have any money. And I had a couple of buddies playing football at Southwest Missouri State. So I thought, well, I'll get a federal grant, and try to go down there and walk on the football team, which means you go on without a scholarship. You just try out, and they either take you or they don't. Well, I got down there, I was ineligible. And by the time I was eligible for football, I was too involved in the theater department.
Why were you ineligible for football?
I never had to take an SAT or something for some reason. And if I know me, my grades were probably not up to snuff.
So since...
And then I got involved in theater through kind of a roundabout way, and that was it. That was love at first sight.
What kind of roles were you playing in college?
Everything. Playing a lot of what they call character roles. And then I lost 65 pounds. Then I started playing, romantic leads and stuff. Then I learned how to sing, doing a lot of leads in musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I'm glad I did that because I got a chance to play leading men like character men. And I think I learned a little bit something from that.
Okay, and you mentioned that you started to sing when you were in college in the theater department?
Right? Yeah, I got a role... A role came up of in the Fantastics, and I had never sung before, so I took a few lessons and auditioned for it, and I got the role.
So you had to sing "Try to Remember."
Yeah, dig that. So I used that for an audition song for years after that, but it was something I'd never experienced before. It was acting. It's like playing Shakespeare, heightened realism. Very stylized acting. That's the way I always thought of it.
Well, I just happen to have one of your singing moments. At the end of the movie True Stories, David Byrne's movie, you sing a song, and you sing it really well. I think the song is written by David Byrne.
Yeah.
But we've got that queued up. I want to play that. Oh, because it sounds so good. So we're going to play some of that, and then we'll talk a little bit more about singing. Here we go.
In 1950, when I was born, Papa couldn't afford to buy us much. He said, "Be proud of what you are. There's something special about people like us."
That's John Goodman singing from the movie True Stories. Is that the same voice that you used for Try to Remember?
No. Different character, different voice. They used to be on the flip side of a Talking Heads single in a a bar I frequented on the west side of Manhattan, and people had put that on to razz me every once in a while. Lordy.
Now, I know when you first went to New York, you got there with a $1,000 loan from your brother.
Yeah.
Did you ever pay him back?
He'd been saving up to just for money in case I wanted to go to grad school or something, and he gave it to me the night I graduated college.
Gee, what a really nice gift.
Yeah, it was. It got me through, about the first 3 or 4 months in New York until I could get some more income.
What did you do your first week in New York?
I was scared. I was terrified. I remember coming out of Penn Station and having the taxi driver take me up to 92nd Broadway where I was staying. And I remember tipping the taxi driver like $5 so I wouldn't get a beating or something. And just looking around and then going out and hitting all the restaurants and bars looking for a waiter's job. And I was just scared. I really wanted to go back to St. Louis and give it up.
Why didn't you?
I didn't want to be humiliated. I have a good, strong sense of embarrassment, so that kept me there. And plus, I really wanted to work. I didn't know. I really had no idea whether I could do it or not. And there was just something that hole needed to be filled.
This I'm only bringing this up because in the second part of our show today, we're interviewing a psychiatrist whose specialty is manic depression. And she's written a book about the connection between the artistic temperament and manic depression. And that's gotten me thinking about mood a lot. So I'm wondering if moods ever enhance or get in the way of a performance, or if you can get out of your mood completely to do the mood that's called for in the part.
When I've found myself coming into the theater or going into a scene extremely angry about something. And for some reason, that's always blown away everything. I don't care who's sitting in the audience. I don't care who's doing what. And it really peps you up. And that for some reason, that seemed to work for me.
Anger.
Yeah. Really popping through things. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but I've just noticed that when I'm extremely angry about something, it just all the other stuff gets blown to the side, and I just pull through and do what I want to do.
You know, you were talking before about how fame can really get in the way, and you can't just walk down the street without people staring or fussing. So where do you go? I mean, like when you're famous and everybody recognizes you, does that mean that you have to go to other places where lots of famous people hang out so that...
Well, I go in Los Angeles. It's not that big of a deal. I go to get away. I have a house in Louisiana next to my in-laws, and nobody really cares there.
Mm-hmm.
Not that big a deal. And there's certain parts of St. Louis to when I go home just to see my buddies and stuff to get away to.
Do you get into this awful bind, though, where on the one hand you want to be away from people who know you and want to talk about your show and stuff, but on the other hand you resent it just a little bit when people don't care who you are?
No, I really like it when people don't know who I am.
Uh-huh.
Or if they just don't care.
Right.
I prefer that. No, there's no resentment. I thought about that because it's kind of a funny situation. But it's not applicable in this case.
Well, John Goodman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Goodman stars in the new movie Born Yesterday, and of course you can see him every week on Roseanne. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lord Byron once said of himself and other poets, "We are all crazy." Coming up, we talk with psychiatrist Kay Jameson about the link between madness and genius. She's just completed a study of manic depression and the artistic temperament. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the remake of Born Yesterday. John Goodman plays the mogul with Melanie Griffith as his bimbo girlfriend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the UN, the Security Council has adopted a resolution that paves the way for the pullout of U.S. troops from Somalia. This resolution also marks the beginning of an unprecedented operation in which the UN will, in effect, take over the administration of the country. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Somalia promises to be the most expensive UN peacekeeping operation ever. It's estimated to cost over $1.5 billion per year. Its mandate is equally large, in essence, to rebuild the country. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright.
By adopting this resolution, we will embark on an unprecedented enterprise aimed at nothing less than the restoration of an entire country as a proud, functioning, and viable member of the community of nations.
The UN will take over command of the military operation from the U.S. on May 1st. U.S. troops are expected to continue their phased withdrawal from Somalia, but so far, no date has been set for their final pullout. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Somalia, U.S.-led forces have started a three-day operation to stop any effort by a key factional leader to take the port city of Kismayu. A military spokesman said it's an effort to make clear resolve to enforce peacemaking plans and show that combat power can be used quickly. U.S. troops will sweep the area for arms believed to have been hidden by militia. Some 2,000 U.S. troops will be deployed on the ground, and more than 2,000 others are to be stationed offshore. Peace talks had to be suspended recently because of new attacks. Threats by Bosnian Serbs have apparently delayed Germany's plans to take part in U.S. nightly airdrops of food and medicine over eastern Bosnia. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
A U.N. spokesman in New York confirmed threats by Bosnian Serbs to attack all airdrop planes if Germany participates in the humanitarian action. The Serbian press has long blamed Germany for provoking the breakup of Yugoslavia through its early recognition of Croatian and Slovenian independence. Since March 1st, U.S. planes have been dropping relief supplies to Muslim enclaves in eastern Bosnia. This week, the German cabinet approved participation of German Transall planes on the nightly flights leaving from Rhein-Main Air Force Base in Frankfurt. But a Bonn Defense Ministry spokesman said the flights were being kept on the ground until the U.N. approved German participation. French, German, and U.S. officials, as well as U.N. officials, are meeting in Germany to discuss a response to the Serbian threats. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 21 points to close at 3,439.98 on volume of more than 219 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. Various reports say that President Clinton's proposed defense budget calls for more than $263 billion in spending next year. Under the plan, some 30,000 U.S. troops would be pulled out of Europe, leaving just under 134,000 troops stationed there. The overall budget reportedly calls for $250.7 billion for the Defense Department and $12.7 billion for the Energy Department and other related programs. The plan is to be announced publicly next week. Once again, violence in Northern Ireland has been on the increase, with five Roman Catholics fatally shot in a 24-hour period. Police have arrested several suspected Protestant extremists in connection with the killings. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
Teenager Dee Walsh was selling coal in a Belfast shopping center yesterday when he was gunned down by two members of the extremist Ulster Freedom Fighters. The group also took responsibility for the shooting of four Catholic men in the town of Castle Rock. The men were murdered as they brewed a cup of tea on the building site where they worked. So far, 24 people have died in Ulster this year, most killed by Protestant extremists. The killings come as the Irish and British governments have renewed their efforts to negotiate a solution to the Northern Ireland problem. Lord Fitt, a veteran Catholic politician, claims Protestant paramilitaries are preying on people's fears about the peace talks. Meanwhile, in Britain today, 3-year-old Jonathan Ball was buried. The boy was killed last week by a bomb planted by the IRA in a shopping center. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Military officials say that a U.S. Navy plane involved in aid flights to Bosnia has crashed off the coast of Italy, and five crew members are missing. The Navy Hawkeye was based on the USS Theodore Roosevelt and was monitoring nighttime airdrops to eastern Bosnia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The mad genius and tormented artist are clichés of popular culture, but there's some truth behind those clichés. Psychiatrist Kay Jamison investigates the connection between manic depressive illness and the artistic temperament in her new book, Touched by Fire. She's found that there's something about the experience of prolonged periods of melancholia, broken by episodes of manic intensity, that leads to insights about the human condition. She writes about some of the celebrated writers, artists, and composers who she believes suffered from mood disorders, including Lord Byron, Virginia Woolf, Robert Lowell, Vincent van Gogh, William Blake, and Charles Ives. Jamison is a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and co-author of a medical text on manic depressive illness. I asked Jamison about the cliché of the mad genius.
The word madness probably is unfortunate because, in fact, most people who have manic depressive illness aren't really mad, and most people who have manic depressive illness are really quite normal most of the time. But the relationship that used to be thought of as just madness and artistic genius has really been narrowed down, I think, in the last 10 or 15 years to being a particular kind of mental instability, and that is manic depressive illness and also depressive illness.
There's a chicken and egg question that comes to mind for me. Does creativity and the sensitivity and perception that go along with it, does that lead to manic depression, or does manic depression lead to the kind of introspection related to creativity?
Well, I think it's really much more the latter. I think that it's more the case that people who have a particular kind of temperament, a particular kind of wiring, a particular kind of sensitivity, introspection, reflection, whatever, tend to go into the arts and gravitate into the arts. Also, the genetics of the illness are such that you really aren't going to become manic depressive unless you have the genetic predisposition to it. It's not to say that there isn't an interaction, and I think there is. I mean, that a particular person with a particular genetic vulnerability to manic depressive illness might go into the arts. There might be some stresses that then trigger off the initial, you know, episode or something through a lack of sleep or stress. But it's certainly not going to cause manic depressive illness in a person who isn't already wired that way.
What are the symptoms of manic depression?
Well, it's really a wide variety of symptoms, but it actually turns out that it's probably the most reliably diagnosed illness in psychiatry, I think unquestionably the most reliably diagnosed. And they're really symptoms of mood and thinking and energy and behavior. In the depressive states, when people are depressed, it's really a slowing down of the entire being. People become lethargic, they lack energy, they lack drive, they lose pleasure, a sense of pleasure in their normal activities, things that usually give them pleasure. Things become gray, flat, colorless. Really, it's less a sad mood than a flat mood and a feeling dead inside. In terms of thinking changes in depression, people get confused often. They get indecisive. Their thinking slows down. People who often are very decisive and fast thinking slow down and can't think with their usual fluidity of thought. Thinking becomes very morbid and obsessive often. People really start withdrawing socially. They start withdrawing from friends and other people. They start withdrawing from colleagues. They just their normal interests just come to a grinding halt for all intents and purposes. Sleep gets very disturbed. People tend to sleep. In the case of manic depressive illness, people tend to sleep far too much usually. They may ordinarily sleep 7 hours a night, and people will start sleeping 10, 15 hours a day, sometimes 20 hours a day. In major depression, people really will sometimes have difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep once they've gotten to sleep. On the other hand, when people get manic, it's really quite the opposite. You see people much more speeded up, highly energetic, highly enthusiastic, full of plans and interests, and things that ordinarily are not interesting all of a sudden become interesting. People start projects and plans. They start staying up later and later each night to the point of getting only 2 or 3 hours of sleep, sometimes no sleep at all. People get very irritable. People in extreme forms of mania get violent, assaultive, very paranoid, and again, in extreme forms, can be delusional and hallucinate.
What about depression? Depression without the mania, is that related to manic depression?
Yes. Depression and manic depressive illness are very closely related. And very often what you will see is actually, and frequently is the case with artists and writers, that people will be diagnosed as having depressive illness rather than manic depressive illness, because the very mild manic states are not seen, and indeed they often are not, disturbing to the person or to the individual. In fact, that's when people often feel that they are most creative and get their most work done. So they aren't diagnosed as having manic depressive illness, they're diagnosed as having depressive disease.
One of the symptoms of mania, the way you describe it, is an incredible belief in the importance of your work and your ideas. That's something you almost have to have as an artist, although you know, so many artists have this interesting combination of insecurity and faith in themselves.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very true. I think one of the things, I mean, clearly you don't have to have manic depressive illness to be an artist. I mean, that goes without saying. And likewise, you don't have to have manic depressive illness to have an extraordinary sense of yourself and your work and the value of your work. But what you often see in manic depressive illness is that when people are high and actually... When they're normal, they feel a certainty in the convictions and in their beliefs. And this is very advantageous to them because they often get criticized a great deal.
I think an issue for a lot of artists who suffer from mood disorders is if they get treatment for it, especially if it's a chemical treatment, will it not only cure their problem, will it cure them of their gift? Will they lose their gift?
Right. Well, I think that's a very long-standing question, and I think it's a very real and an important question, and I think it's the one that the medical community, the psychiatric community, is going to have to take very seriously. I think many in the medical community do take it seriously, but I think perhaps the side effects of some of the medications have not been dealt with perhaps as effectively as they could. I think there's several things. It's a complicated issue. It's like manic depressive illness in general. It's very hard to understand or reconcile that an illness can have both very positive aspects to it and very negative aspects to it. And that's one of the things that makes manic depressive illness so interesting but also difficult to comprehend in some ways. Likewise, the treatment is very complicated. I think there's no question that lithium and the anticonvulsant medications that are used to treat manic depressive illness have prevented suicide, and the studies on that are very consistent. No one is creative when they're dead by suicide. No one's creative when they're 6 feet under or in four-point restraints on a psychiatric ward or when they're morbidly depressed or wildly psychotic. I think that's a given. Likewise, as I said, it's a disease. It gets worse over time, and it gets harder to treat over time. So that you may start off with a mild case, and it may progress to a much worse case.
Are there any case studies of artists who have taken chemical therapy for mood disorders, and how the prescription has affected their work?
Well, yes, there are. I mean, for a lot of reasons, obviously confidentiality. It's difficult because the medications that are being used are actually reasonably new. Additions to medicine. Robert Lowell certainly was on lithium. He felt he was more productive and creative. I think that's a little bit controversial. There are people who have been studied. There are two studies of artists and writers who, in fact, pointed out that they felt like they were more productive on lithium than they had been before lithium. However, there are also side effects to lithium, and one of the things that's good now is that people now tend to be kept on much lower levels of lithium than used to be the case 5 or 10 years ago, and many of these side effects that were dulling to people are not as much of a problem now, and likewise, the anticonvulsants don't tend to have the same kind of effects on energy and mood and thinking that lithium alone had. So I think that the medications now are more sophisticated. From my point of view, the most important thing is that people have choices. If you look at Byron and Schumann and Tennyson and Coleridge, they all went to their doctors. They were desperate. Van Gogh, was voluntarily admitted after he'd been involuntarily admitted. These people wanted help. They desperately wanted help. They were miserably unhappy. They were often suicidal. They didn't have any choices. I mean, people now have choices.
As you point out, bizarre behavior is often considered normal if it occurs in an artist.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that's affected the way we treat artists in America and also the way the psychiatric profession treats artists?
Well, I think it's in a funny sort of way, it's led to a certain amount of discrimination, because I think that, you know, on the one hand, you really don't want to reduce, just because somebody's moody or eccentric or strange or a bit bizarre, that doesn't mean the person needs to be on medication or be in psychotherapy or anything of the sort. You want to have a wide tolerance for, you know, individual behavior. On the other hand, you don't want to say, well, this person is an artist, therefore it's perfectly understandable this person is miserably unhappy, suicidal, can't produce, can't write, can't think, can't hold down a relationship. You know, that's not fair. Again, I think it's just that you want to give people choices about what they do with their lives, and they may opt. They may say, this is what I want to do. I don't want to be treated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kay Redfield Jamison, the author of the new book Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about manic depressive illness and the artistic temperament. My guest is Kay Redfield Jamison. She's a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. In your book, you say that manic depression is indisputably genetic. Now, I was reading a recent New York Times article that says that new studies can't find a gene that would be responsible for it. So scientists now think that mental illnesses are likely to be a result of many genes malfunctioning in subtle ways. What do you think?
Well, I think that those things aren't incompatible. I think it is indisputably genetic. I think that the family studies, the adopted twin studies, the evidence, I think, is overwhelming that it's genetic. That one hasn't found the genes doesn't mean it isn't genetic. I mean, one hasn't found the actual gene for Huntington's disease, for example, but that doesn't mean it isn't a genetic illness. I think that it will almost certainly be more than one gene. I don't think very many people think it's going to be a single gene, and it's bound to be complicated. But the issues that arise from it being genetic are the same. It doesn't make any difference what the underlying mechanism ends up being, how complicated, whether it's a single gene, 5, 10, 15 genes interacting in a complex sort of way. The genetic issues remain the same, the ethical issues.
Can you tell me more about what you think the connection is between manic depression and the ability to write or paint or sing or perform, you know, the ability to create? Why are those two related?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that go into it. One is that obviously you don't just take somebody who has average ability, give them manic depressive illness, and make them a great artist or painter. You take somebody who has enormous ability anyway. But what you do is you're adding a temperament and you're adding a way of thinking and you're adding a range of emotional experiences. So when people get mildly manic, for example, and you can show this in psychological tests, you can show it in any number of ways, people start thinking much more fluidly, they think more quickly, they have many more associations. So if I were to say to you, give you the word frog and ask you to associate to the word frog, you could come up with a sort of X number of responses to that. And you would come up with a certain number of original responses to that. When people get mildly manic, what you find is they get both more, they come up with more responses and more original responses. People become more fiery, impulsive. They take more chances. The associational patterns just set off like wildfire across the mind often. And you can see this literally on PET scans and so forth. You can see that just the brain is lit up like a Christmas tree when people are mildly manic. Likewise, when people get mildly depressed, I think that people get more melancholic, they get more reflective, they think about things that most of us don't want to think about. Denial tends to be the first thing to go. And traditionally, we have asked artists and writers to do our dealing with the grim aspects of life for us. And in fact, that's what happens when people get depressed. They tend to deal with issues of how ephemeral it all is, how short life is, how transient it is, how morbid perhaps the core of things actually is. But very importantly, it's the fact that people are going in and out of these states. They're feeling normal at one moment and depressed another and feeling very enthusiastic and having to reconcile the differences across these states of high enthusiasms and suicidal thinking and whatever.
In your practice, do you treat artists with manic depression any differently than you would treat someone who wasn't an artist and was suffering from the same problem?
Well, it depends on the individual. I mean, there are a lot of people who have manic depressive illness who aren't artists and writers, but who love the arts, for example, or who are sensitive, or who have problems where they have to write or have to produce.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, I mean, I live in Washington. There are a lot of politicians who need to be able to function on a day-to-day basis. That's true of people in business. It's true of people in the law. It's true of people in medicine. It's true of people, whatever job or profession they hold down. People need to be able to function in order to maintain relationships and maintain jobs. I think in the case of people in the arts, by and large, you can encourage people to read more, perhaps, along biographical lines, because people have written a lot about what it feels like to have severe depression and manic depressive illness. But then I recommend that for a lot of my patients. I recommend that they read biographies or that they read, you know, original writings or poetry or whatever.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Kay Redfield Jamison is the author of the new book Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament. She's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Mike Schuster in Moscow today, Terry, about the latest in the political struggle between Boris Yeltsin and the Russian parliament. Also, a talk with historian Martin Malia of the University of California, Berkeley, about why we should be assisting Boris Yeltsin and how we might actually assist the processes of democratization and economic reform in Russia. Phyllis Crockett reports on the search for a successor to Benjamin Hooks as executive director of the NAACP, and whether or not the Reverend Jesse Jackson really has a chance of getting that job. And we'll also be hearing from an author who has compiled the way different languages report the sounds of dogs, cats, pigs, sheep, and other animals.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When Born Yesterday came out in 1950, it seemed an almost perfect screen comedy with a snappy Garson Kanin script, silky direction by George Cukor, and a legendary Oscar-winning performance by Judy Holliday as the ultimate dumb blonde. Hollywood Pictures has remade the film with Melanie Griffith in the Judy Holliday role and John Goodman as her millionaire boyfriend. Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look at the results.
What's immediately clear is that this movie was born long before yesterday. So long, in fact, that it's hard to figure out how anyone could ever dream of remaking it in 1993. The original had a point, which was that women aren't merely objects, that they have brains, and that no matter how attractive a woman's face and form, an education can only enhance her. 20 years after the birth of contemporary feminism, and 10 years into the career of Madonna, that point is no less true, but it's sure a lot less fresh and relevant. Director Louis Mandoki and screenwriter Douglas McGrath have been startlingly, even foolishly, faithful to the original. They give us John Goodman as real estate magnate Harry Brock, who's come to Washington to bribe some senators. He's brought his girlfriend, Billy Dawn, played by Melanie Griffith. She's a bimbo so bimbo-esque that she doesn't even know what the White House is. Then there's reporter Paul Verrill, played by Don Johnson. He wants to write an article about Harry Brock, but Brock has another idea. He wants Paul to tutor poor dumb Billy, to smarten her up so that she won't embarrass him in front of all the Washington bigwigs. The point, of course, is that inside that fluffy blonde head, there's a working brain that big Harry Brock has never appreciated, and that once Billy develops it, she'll realize what a cad Brock is and fall in love with her tutor, Paul. But first we get the requisite Pygmalion scenes, with Billy trying to read Tocqueville. And I mean, Tocqueville's not easy. I mean, it's frustrating.
I mean, this whole thing is making me feel dumber, not smarter. I've been reading this book for a week, and I'm on page 13.
Well, that's not so bad.
Yeah, not if the book's 14 pages, it's not.
Billy, it's not supposed to go fast. It's supposed to make you think.
Yeah, it makes you think, all right. It makes you think how great it would be to sit around and watch TV. I don't want to do this anymore, Paul. I quit. I mean it.
Billy,
I quit.
Billy, wait a minute. Being smart isn't just about books. It's about asking questions. It's about finding out why things are the way they are. Don't stop reading. But you picked a kind of a big book to begin with. How about starting with something a little smaller?
Like what? Fortune cookie?
That's how the whole movie plays, like an after-school special. I suppose there are would-be high school dropouts out there in movie land who need to be told that education is a good thing. But would-be dropouts are not a likely audience for this low-suds froth about an ex-showgirl on Washington's embassy party circuit. As for the rest of us, well, Born Yesterday feels as though it were happening very far from planet Earth. As Paul, Don Johnson gives an adequate performance, but not one that uses any of his gifts for danger and temperament. John Goodman would seem to be wonderful casting as Harry Brock, but the problem is he's too wonderful. You keep sympathizing with him and hoping he'll wind up with the girl, which is exactly what the movie wants you not to hope. And then there's Melanie Griffith. She's played plenty of candy-voiced dumb bunnies who turn out to be Susan Sontag once you give them the chance, so the role of Billy would seem to be a natural for her, but it's not. Her languid sexuality is so powerful that she never looks weak enough to suit the movie's purposes. You always get the feeling that she could steamroll over any tycoon or senator in her path. What she can't steamroll over is the bad movie choices she's made, practically from the day she was nominated for an Oscar in Working Girl. Griffith is in trouble. She'll lose her edge and her audience if she keeps making career decisions as though she really were Born Yesterday.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's Academy Awards Day, and we talk with one of America's leading film critics, Terrence Rafferty. He writes for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.